Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I hear they've given me a name. They're calling me the Ripper.
Within the space of a single year, Anthony John Hardy had murdered his first victim, evaded a lengthy custodial sentence, manipulated his detention in a psychiatric unit, and being declared not a danger to himself or others, he was released back into the community and to his flat at 4 Heartland. 6 weeks later, two more women would be dead, with their dismembered bodies scattered across Camden. Once he was nothing but an anonymous homeless drunk who was ignored, avoided, and abandoned. But now, his dark ambition to become a serial killer was complete. Unlike his eponymous East End hero, whose moniker is known the world over, Tony's infamy was yet to be cemented. He was a nobody who wanted to be a somebody. But to achieve it, the next step was out of his control. So who was Anthony Hardy? Was he a depressed alcoholic who was prone to manic episodes? Was his mental health real, imaginary, impossible to diagnose, or entirely fabricated to suit his needs? Was he a chancer who grabbed his opportunities, or a cunning manipulator with a long-term goal? Did his addictions make a monster? Did his isolation craft a killer? Or was his sadism always part of his personality? The truth about the Camden Ripper may never be known, even to himself, as he became a different person to different people at different times. But only by viewing this story from his perspective is it possible to see the four sides of the personality of Anthony Hardy. The alcoholic, the addict, the sadist, and the maniac. These are the four faces of the Camden Ripper. Part 4. Tony, the Maniac. Detective Chief Inspector Ken Ball later said, "It was one of the most disturbing cases I have ever been involved with. It has always been the belief of the investigating team that a man in full possession of his mental faculties committed these murders. Hardy is a dangerous, devious, and manipulative man." In the eyes of the Met Police, Anthony Hardy was a sadistic murderer. Plain and simple. Following the discovery of the naked and posed body of Sally Rose White, there was enough evidence of assault, premeditation, an attempt to conceal the body, and his convenient loss of memory owing to an alcoholic blackout was without merit. But with the murder investigation usurped by the bungling of a Home Office pathologist, their case collapsed and their only suspect was released. But soon enough, the police would be proved right. Mid-afternoon, on Thursday the 2nd of January 2003, Tony was sat in an oak-panelled smoking room at Great Ormond Street Hospital, a few streets from King's Cross Station. Sprawled across a stiff wooden bench, wearing his shin-length coat, black NY cap, loud shirt and amusing socks, Tony smoked a ciggy as he perused the paper. His beard was gone, shaved to a ragged stubble. And although it was bitterly cold outside, with a persistently biting drizzle, inside, the radiators were reassuringly warm and comforting. One of London's largest ever manhunts was underway. The police were patrolling the streets. His flat was crawling with forensics, and Tony's face was splashed across every tabloid. The papers would state that this mentally disturbed and highly dangerous man had been on the run for 3 days. When in truth, he wasn't running. He was in no rush at all. As all he had to do now was wait. 7 days earlier, on Friday the 27th of December 2002, Elizabeth Vallad and Bridget McLellan had served their purpose. Their bodies were rotting, flies were swarming, and purge fluid was slowly leaking from their bloated corpses as their internal organs putrefied in the heat of this squalid little flat at 4 Hartland. A total of 44 sickeningly lurid photos were taken of both ladies, posed on the bed, lying naked, with all holes gaping, as they fulfilled every facet of his sick, disturbing fantasy. Only with the redhead Bridget 3 days dead, and her porcelain skin mottled with a vivid hue of reds and blues, and Liz's one slender frame malformed by the warmth of decay into a purple bloated mess with slipping skin. For Tony, it was time to dispose of the evidence. Only this wasn't a race to cut and flush as much human meat as possible. This was slow and methodical for a very specific reason. In an advanced state of decomposition, both bodies were limp and easy to handle as he dragged them from the spare room into the white windowless bathroom. With the cold tap on and the plug out, the fluids were slowly drained. The bulk of the Friday he spent dismembering the bodies, with a small white hacksaw and 3 kitchen knives with differing blades. Some sharp for skin, some tough for bone, some jagged for sinew. But no bones were snapped in haste, as each cut was clean, as if performed by a professional butcher. But for Tony, this wasn't only about a sadistic gratification or the full physical control of a woman. Here, he was creating a myth. There are thousands of serial killers in history. Some are famous, some are forgotten, but very few are infamous. Having left 16 bits of limbs, torsos and heads to drain in the bath, at 8:04 p.m., he re-entered the Sainsbury's on Camden Road to buy more bin bags. Where he aroused no suspicion, he didn't disguise his face from the CCTV, and having made his purchase, he even remembered to collect his Nectar card points. The next day, with a roll of bin bags, a set of red-handled scissors, and a reel of duct tape, each part was bagged and sealed in his more spacious spare room. He cleaned the bathroom so it was white once again, and then he showered, scrubbed his nails, and popped on some fresh clothes. Conveniently, the bin store at Hartland was in front of his own front door. Only this wasn't about speed, as where and how the bodies were dumped was a key part of his myth-making. At 2:08 p.m, on the corner of Plender Street and Camden Road, Tony dumped a large black bag filled with an upper torso, a right arm, a left arm and a foot into the bin. Having stopped, turned and grinned up towards a CCTV camera directly overhead, and then calmly, he walked away. One street down from his home, he slung a second bag bulging with a pair of ladies' legs. On the floor of his spare room, he left Liz's headless and limbless torso, all parceled up, having locked the door and blocked the gap below with her grey tracksuit bottoms. And then, nearby, he disposed of the rest. 3 feet, two arms, and both heads. On the morning of the 30th of December 2002, with a large police presence at the back of the College Arms pub, he shaved off his beard, packed up a small bag, and calmly he left his flat at 4 Hartland forever. With 3 women dead, their bodies scattered, and his myth-making finally complete, as his infamy could never be guaranteed, Tony would have to wait, as the final piece of his legend was yet to be written. So where did the Camden Ripper begin? Well, his homicidal sadism didn't start with Sally Rose White, Elizabeth Selina Vallad, or Bridget Cathy McClellan. It actually began with his first victim, his wife. Anthony John Hardy was born on the 31st of May 1951 in Winchill, a coal mining parish east of Burton-on-Trent in Staffordshire, to Kathleen, a housewife, and Cyril, a welder at the Swaddling Coat Colliery. As the fourth youngest son, alongside Barry, Terry, Christine and Brian, it's unsurprising that, like most bullies, Tony would unwittingly model himself on those he feared the most. As his father was a large, stout man with a short fuse, a furious temper, and a thirst for drinking women. Raised a Christian, as a boy, the seeds of the serial killer were sown, as Tony was quiet, bright, and charming, but lacked empathy for anyone. From 1956 to 1970, Tony was schooled at Abbotsbane Grammar in Winchill, where he fostered a love of girls, a passion for mechanics, and a deep desire to flee his working-class roots. And although he could be chatty and pleasant to his fellow pupils, he despised his teachers, often dismissing their questions with a vacant look, very few words, and a need to feel superior over these authority figures. Gifted with practical hands and a methodical mind, from 1970 to 73, Tony studied engineering at Imperial College in Kensington, West London, where Tony met and fell in love with 22-year-old Judith Dwight. To Judith, having fallen for a tall, well-built man who was described as a perfect gentleman, in the spring of 1972, they married at Westminster Registry Office. In 1975, they moved to Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk, where Tony worked as a factory engineer for British Sugar, Judith as a secretary, and their 4 children, Sam, Ben, Emma and Tom, soon followed. In 1978, with Tony offered a great opportunity, the family uprooted to Hobart in Tasmania. But struggling to cope with the stresses of life, he smoked, he drank, he womanized, and the sadistic seeds of a fledgling serial killer began to spawn. Described as like a Jekyll and Hyde, for Judith, it was like living with 2 different husbands. As swinging wildly from high manias to low depressions, violent outbursts to utter blankness, Tony's mood was unpredictable. To curb it, he drank heavier, had many affairs, used sex workers, and yet to be diagnosed with onset diabetes, his unruly erections required harder sex to maintain his large libido. Losing his job, for the sake and safety of their marriage and children, Judith got Tony to see a doctor. But as his anger and mania grew, being misdiagnosed, he was incorrectly prescribed with antidepressants. It was then that, being neither drunk, low, or elated, Tony would plan and execute his first murder. On the 5th of April 1982, at 6:30 a.m., as the family slept, Tony went to the kitchen and opened the fridge. He wasn't hungry or thirsty, as all he could think about was his wife's impending death. In his eyes, he had planned it to perfection, as with no murder weapon found, he knew that he would evade justice. Having read in a true crime novel about an assassin's dagger made of ice, he adapted the idea and froze a plastic water bottle which had been used as a cooler for picnics. After the attack, the ice would defrost, and the bottle would be indistinguishable from any other piece of rubbish. As he swung the 2-liter bottle, almost 2 kilos of hardened ice smashed Judith repeatedly over the head as she slept. It shot intense pains down her body and rendered her stunned and semi-conscious. Dragging her limp body to the bath, Tony thrust his wife's head under the water in an attempt to drown her. But as she fought back, she kicked, she punched, and she struggled to yank out the plug. The attack abruptly stopped when their 6-year-old son, Sam, saw his dad attacking his mum and screamed. Judith was taken to hospital with cuts, bruises and shock. And thankfully, she survived. So whether Tony's failure informed his further attacks is unknown. Did the sound of his neighbour's bath at Heartland trigger a manic flashback? Were his last 3 victims simply him enacting what he wanted to happen to his wife? And was his manipulation of their bodies an act of revenge because he couldn't obtain hers? That is unknown. But many key elements which shaped the Camden murders would stem from this very moment. Upon his arrest, Tony stated
"no comment"
to the police's questions, and only spoke to flag up his alcoholic blackouts, his depression, and his need for psychiatric help. On the 6th of April 1982, Tony was sectioned at Brisbane's Park Centre Psychiatric Unit. Like his admission to the Mornington unit, once inside, with the charges dropped, his suicidal urges had ceased, and as a model patient, he was declared not a danger to others or himself, and discharged after just 10 days. But as would later happen at the Cardigan ward, he wasn't diagnosed with depression or bipolar, but suffering from a cyclothymic reaction, meaning his violent moods weren't owing to a mental illness, but were part of his personality. 2 weeks later, Tony held his wife hostage in a hotel room. She later filed divorce papers and moved back to England. And although a decree nisi was later served, his violence towards his soon-to-be ex-wife didn't stop there. In August 1985, as they still lived together owing to their dwindling finances, Tony tortured Judith with these petty torments. He soaked her bed with water. He broke her secretarial typewriter. He stole all of the money in her purse. And for the last 3 days, before she finally left their matrimonial home, he turned up the radio full so she couldn't sleep. In November 1986, on the grounds of domestic assault, the divorce was issued and a restraining order was put in place, meaning that Tony couldn't contact his wife or children in any way. He broke those terms, served 2 months in prison, and losing his job, he focused his time on making her life a living hell. 8th of December 1986, he harassed Judith with phone calls day and night. 11th of December, while the police were installing alarms in her home, they found microphones hidden in the vents. 14th of December, he made more abusive calls. 2nd of January 1987, he followed his wife's car all the way to London. 12th of January, within 5 hours of changing her ex-directory number, there were more menacing calls. 19th of January, she got a postcard which read, "Is there a chink in your armor, I wonder? Tony." 27th of January, he slashed her friend's car's tires. 28th of January, he left a voicemail saying, "If you persist in refusing to talk to me, you'll be sorry." 8th of June, he bricked her window and slashed her tires. 9th of July, he broke into her home at night, leaving a cigarette stub and her tires slashed. 13th of July, another window bricked, and a note attached stating, This brick was chosen with care. I hope you like it. T. The same day, five cars on the street had their tires slashed, and she received another note stating, To the stars or to hell, the choice is yours. And on the 21st of July 1987, he broke into her home, boarded up the garage, jammed the front door, stole her friend's car, changed the number plates, and used it for a spot of illegal minicabbing and to harass and stalk his ex-wife as she tried to live her life. On the 16th of September 1987, he was sentenced to 1 year in prison for contempt of court, having ignored the restraining order. While on remand in Norwich Prison for car theft, a psychiatrist for the Norvik Clinic assessed Tony and found no evidence of major mental illness, and that his violence towards his ex-wife resulted from an intractable personality trait. Meaning, he wasn't mentally ill. This was part of who he was. Having served his sentence, on the 2nd of January 1989, he stole the car of his ex-wife's boyfriend, and while high on alcohol and cannabis, he organised a belated New Year's Eve party for a group of sex workers, which ended in a high-speed police chase down the A134 and crashed into a roadblock at Thetford. Upon his arrest, he refused to give a specimen, repeatedly stated,
"No comment."
He caused criminal damage to his cell and was sentenced to a further 6 months in prison.
Hello. My name is Tony, and I'm an alcoholic.
And this was where we began. In the summer of 1989, as Tony drove his battered Ford Sierra through the back streets of King's Cross. Within a year, he was unemployed, homeless, and diabetic. Over the next 13 years, he was arrested, evicted, and sectioned on countless occasions. And having nothing of his own, he had learned to manipulate the system to get exactly what he wanted. Whether a bed, a meal, an income, a flat, or the freedom to walk the streets, having got away with murder. With three women dead, their bodies scattered, and his myth-making finally complete, as his infamy could never be guaranteed, Tony would have to wait, as the final piece of his legend was yet to be written. On Monday the 30th of December 2002, just shy of 3 a.m, as the urban foxes prowled behind the College Arms pub, hungry and shunned, seen as vermin by an uncaring society, another nameless scavenger foraged in the council bins for food. Only what this young Irishman found shocked him to the core. He later said, "I thought there were two big fish, like two big salmon. I opened the bag, and there they were. A pair of women's legs." The press would later claim that Tony was only caught because the rubbish collection was a day late. But as anyone who lives in Britain knows, every Christmas it's late. This discovery wasn't a mistake. It was deliberate. As how could Tony become an infamous serial killer if no one knew about his killings? At 9 a.m, the homeless man carried the reeking bin bag to the Hospital for Tropical Diseases on Capper Street. at 9:45 a.m., Detective Chief Inspector Ken Ball was alerted to reports of suspected human remains. At 10 a.m., the rear of the pub was sealed off. And seeing the commotion from the comfort of his own flat, Tony calmly packed a bag, grabbed his pills, shaved off his beard, and left Heartland forever. There was no rush, no panic, no fear. And knowing that his moment had almost come, he probably even stopped to watch. At 11 a.m. at St. Pancras Mortuary, an autopsy by Dr. Freddie Patel confirmed their worst fears. The legs were human, female, recently dismembered, and more than likely, they belonged to more than one woman. A murder investigation was set up. The estate was cordoned off, bins were emptied, residents were questioned, and rubbish collections were stopped. Although thousands of tons had already been taken to landfill. No other body parts were initially found. But when the neighbours were asked, the same name kept cropping up. When the police arrived, it was as if he had been expecting them, as the front door was open and the hall light was on. But Tony was nowhere to be found. Initially, it looked like a false lead, as although clean but cluttered, it resembled the flat of a depressed alcoholic who was blamed for everything. To experienced detectives, these seemingly innocent items rankled their nerves. Like the rubber devil's mask, the occult symbols, the stack of sickening porn, the creepy childish daubings which hinted towards other victims, a scattering of scrawled letters written to sex workers, escorts and S&M magazines, all alluding to his depraved cravings. And a painted glass jar, immortalising that first murder of Sally Rose White. But most of all, beyond the bleach and the incense, they were hit with the recognisable and unforgettable festering reek of decaying flesh. So pungent, it permeated the grey tracksuit bottoms which blocked the gap under the door and lingered in their nostrils. Having forced the door, the spare room was as Tony had left it. A treasure trove of irrefutable evidence connecting him to the murder to the victim. On the table were spare bin bags, a roll of duct tape, some scissors, a pair of marigold gloves, and carefully positioned on the red rug, neatly wrapped and sealed, with the tools of a dissection placed on top, lay the headless and limbless torso of Elizabeth Vallad. The hacksaw held jagged nicks of flesh. The knives were still bloodstained. Luminol confirmed the areas of death, dismemberment and disposal. And the only fingerprints found were the victim's and Tony's. The next day, the search expanded to the canal, landfill, and the neighbouring estate, where in a green council bin on Plender Street, an upper torso, a right arm, a left arm and a foot was found. Bridget McClellan was identified by her DNA, and Elizabeth Vallad by the serial numbers of her breast implants. And although an extensive search was conducted, the hands and heads remained missing. Tony was the police's prime suspect. With one of London's largest manhunts set up, the newspapers were given his photo and description, and knowing his reliance on medication for his depression and diabetes, St. Pancras and St. Luke's hospitals were alerted, but they had already missed him. Tony was gone, having lived for a decade as an invisible vagrant on London streets. It wasn't difficult for him to vanish without trace. He slept rough, ate hot meals in charity-run kitchens, and having shaved off his beard, less to evade the police and more to avoid a public lynching, His days were spent reading the trashy tabloids, who slathered over the grisly details of his murders, dubbing him with a series of lurid, salacious nicknames, whether as the King's Cross Killer, the Camden Slasher, or the Binbag Maniac. Tony knew that his moment of infamy was soon, very soon. But until then, he would wait. In the mid-afternoon of Thursday, the 2nd of January 2003, Mike Burrows, an off-duty policeman, was sitting with his son in the wood-panelled smoking room at Great Ormond Street Hospital, when he spotted a large, stout man in a shin-length coat, a black NY cap, a loud shirt, and a set of amusing socks, smoking a cigarette and reading the newspaper. To his son, Mike whispered, "You see him? Doesn't that look like the bin bag man?" And that was it. Security was alerted, the police arrived, and upon his arrest, although many articles falsely claimed that he fought his way out, with one constable losing an eye and another stabbed, in truth, he was calm and polite. The wait was over. The moment had come. And as the officers led him away, Tony grinned and said,
"I hear they've given me a name. They're calling me the Ripper."
Taken to Colindale Police Station, and questioned by DS Alan Bostock and DCI Ken Ball, their evidence against him was irrefutable, but their focus was more humane. When the DCI asked, "I want to recover the heads, not for me, for the families. What can you do for me, Tony?" Being a sadist, with a hatred of authority and a need to furnish his myth, as he did with every question, Tony replied,
"No comment."
On Tuesday the 25th of November 2003, at the Old Bailey, 52-year-old Anthony John Hardy pleaded guilty to the brutal murders of Sally Rose White, Elizabeth Selina Vallad, and Bridget Cathy McClellan, and was sentenced to 3 life sentences. In May 2010, this was extended to a whole life tariff. No one knows why he pleaded guilty. It's unlikely he did it to spare the families the agony of hearing the evidence. More likely is that with an insatiable press perched in the gallery, he knew that the little they heard, the moral mystique would surround this infamous British serial killer known as the Camden Ripper. Very little was written about this case, and although the supposedly accidental death of Sally Rose White was overruled, and the pathologist Dr. Freddie Patel was dismissed, the most conclusive public review of this case was into the treatment of Anthony Hardy as a mental health patient under the care of Camden Council. Held at Broadmoor Psychiatric Prison and later transferred to HMP Frankland, he sought a biographer to write his story. He asked Christie's to auction off his macabre souvenirs, and he even requested that his clothes should be sent to Madame Tussauds so his effigy could stand in the Chamber of Horrors next to Dr. Crippen and Reg Christie. On the 26th of November 2020, Anthony John Hardy died of sepsis in prison. His face is hardly known. His crimes are rarely discussed. There are very few biographies in his name. And having died just 2 weeks earlier, his demise was usurped by a vastly more infamous serial killer, the Yorkshire Ripper. So as much as he craved infamy, dead or alive, the Camden Ripper has almost been forgotten. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was the final part of the 4-part series into the Camden Ripper, and the final Murder Mile for 2020. Across the next 8 to 10 weeks, I shall be researching the new season, and I hope to return by the end of February 2021. But if you'd like to know more about this case, stay tuned for some more extra bits, as well as a quiz, a bickie, and a final cup of tea with me. Before that, a big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Nick Ashworth, Dawn Ackrill, and Natasha Turner-Swift. I thank all of you very much. I hope you've received and enjoy your goodies, and that you'll enjoy the new online goodies, which all Patreon subscribers will be receiving in January and February. Ooh! Plus a thank you to Lucy Barr and Darren DeRosa for your very kind donations via the Murder Mile eShop. I thank you. I've spent it on booze. And a special hello to my boaty neighbour, Heather, who I bumped into the other day. Only you know where I'm currently moored up for Christmas, so keep it a secret. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good fabric is stretch. Oh, there we go, people. Hey, it's extra mile time. How are we all? Are we all good? Are we all happy? Are we all well? Let's put me tea on now while I'm thinking about it. Cord in, maybe. Yeah, let's just open up a there we go. Oh, it's a lovely day, so it'd be silly not to have the windows open and get some fresh air in. Cool-lummy. There we go. Right. Tea bag in. Sugar in. A little bit more. There we go. Good. That's it to go. Right, coming back.
Cool-lummy. Lummy. Right.
What do you wait? So we've got a tea on the go. And some going back to the old favourite, Tesco's Finest has a little star next to it. I guess that means you've got to check to see what they mean by the word finest. 4 triple chocolate shortbreads. Ooh, these are the really buttery ones that you eat, and they're very buttery. And oh, yes, contains wheat, milk, soya, and gluten. Good. And chocolate. Oh, look at all that goodies. How many calories per bar? I don't know, it's weird how they always do it this way. They always say per 100 grams. So you have to go in, you have to go, right, how many grams are in a pack? And it's just like, one of the cakes I picked up ages ago, it said each serving contains like 300 calories. And I was like, well, how do you know what a serving is? Because it was a cake and it was uncut. So it's like, I could eat that. If I eat the whole cake, surely the whole cake is just 300 calories. So why eat a little bit? It's just they really make it really difficult, don't they? Anyway, hope you enjoyed that. That was the final part of the 4 Faces of the Camden Ripper. I've got a couple of days of editing ahead of me to do, and then I think I'm going to be finished for a bit. A little bit more work on Murder Mile and some extra stuff. Then I'm going to roll out an omnibus edition of this episode, because I always do that at the end of the season, so that'll be good. As mentioned, January, February coming up, obviously I've got no cases to kind of report on, but for everyone who was a Patreon subscriber. Over January and February, when Murder Mile is offline, I'll be doing some interesting stuff. So I'm not too sure what I'm going to do, but there'll be lots of stuff every week to keep you entertained. So whether I do some weekly Q&As or some live chats, there'll be some extra videos of stuff which you'll never see anywhere else. Lots of new goodies. Obviously, an advanced preview of all the cases coming up. I'll be doing some videos at the National Archives, kind of doing my daily chats where I go, this is what I'm working on today. I might do some Ask Me Anything questions. So there'll be some interesting stuff on there. So if you are interested, you can sign up. You can support Murder Mile by Patreon. I started off as something I thought just a bit of fun, but it's actually, given the way the year has gone, it's actually become kind of my main income now. So it's kind of become quite important. But for as little as $3 a month, or in real money, that's £2, probably less than £2, you can support Murder Mile, but you get loads of goodies every week. And for everyone who subscribes $3 and above, which is nothing, I send you, it's worth about £5 in total, all the cost of it, or it's worth about £8 if you're somewhere else, because I have to post it miles away. But it's a lovely little thank you card full of goodies and all the exclusive kind of fridge magnets and badges and stuff like that that I'll send you as well. So that's all good, just doing my water. There we go, pop that in, let the tea brew. And they have the Patreon have just set up a new thing, which a lot of people are taking advantage of, which is instead of subscribing every month, or you pay you $3 a month, if you subscribe for the year, you save 16% or something. So a lot of people are converting to that. It, pays for the year. You don't have to think about it, which is all very good. So that's that. Just a quick reminder, because I haven't got an episode going out next year. So Crime Con happening next June in London, fantastic weekend, a true crime weekend with 50 hours of entertainment and loads of podcasters and loads of really exciting stuff. The early bird tickets are going to end on the 1st of January, so they're the cheaper early bird tickets, finish on the 1st of January. So if you want to treat yourself to a fantastic weekend of true crime fun and meet loads of true crime people, and I will be there as well, and many of your favourite true crime podcasters from the UK and overseas as well, there's a link in the show notes. And if you use, as mentioned, if you use the offer code MILE, you will save 10%. And I send you goodies as well, which is all very good. All very good. What's happening at the moment? I'm stocking up on my Christmas booze ready for Christmas, which is all very good. So I've just above the engine, which is always very quiet, cold up there. I've got all my booze. So I've got some of the layer cake that I've mentioned, which is very nice. Tiramisu stout. I've got some loads of different beers and lagers, and got some crisps and some cakes. And for Amy, who's coming over on Christmas Day, I've already bought her spiced rum and coke, which is all ready. Couldn't find any of that almond Baileys, unfortunately. Tesco's didn't seem to have any. But other stuff. So we're going to have a good Christmas. It'll be good fun. And my friend Colin's coming over on the morning, so we're going to have good bacon sandwiches. I'm going to find some good bread, some good bacon sandwiches, some good ketchup. Got to do it properly. Good bit of mustard in there as well. And by the time you listen to this, I would have had my Christmas party. So it's a Murder Mile Christmas party. Because I work for myself, I always have one day where I celebrate. So I treat myself to something nice. And everyone always... not this year, we're not going to do it, are we? But normally people go out and they go... have a Christmas party and they all get really drunk and stuff like that. I sit by myself somewhere watching a film. But this year, to treat myself, it's been a hard year, it's been difficult, I'm going to treat myself to a nice big Chinese meal. Whoa. So I'll probably show pictures of that online. It's going to be, I'm going to spend about 40 quid, I reckon. And there's going to be lots of beers and I'll be groaning for the rest of the week about how full I am. So that'll be good. So by the time I've finished all my work, I think Christmas Day will be my first day off, which will be very exciting. And then I'm going to have a couple of days, probably a week or hopefully 10 days of not doing any writing, not doing any research. I've got to strip the paint off the roof for the boat and get it ready, because I'm taking her into dry dock again to do some repairs. So that'll be good, which I'm all ready for. Get the engine service, stuff like that. So, right, that's all. That was exciting, wasn't it? Right, gonna grab my tea. Just knocked the thingy. Right. Stirry. Get the bag out. Oops. Right. Oh, it's a lovely day outside. It's one of those days where you think to yourself, I really don't want to be indoors editing, but I need to power through this. Really clear day. It's one of those crisp winter days where it's bright and shiny and you just go, oh, that's nice. I'd like to be outside. Unfortunately, it's ruined by the sound of children. Children. Horrible sound. Ugh. Right. Okay, let's do some questions. Question number one. What country did Tony and his family move to in the late 1970s? Question number two. What company was Tony a factory engineer for after university? Question number three. Tony's first prison sentence was for what? Question number four. The Park Centre Psychiatric Unit was in which city? Is that a city or is it a state? Not too sure. Should have checked that. Question five. Tony was raised where? East of Burton-on-Trent. Unfortunately, I can't call it a town because it's not a town. It's not really a village either. It's regarded as a settlement, which is why I can't... Because Burton-on-Trent is a town, but Tony was raised where? East of Burton-on-Trent. It makes it very difficult when you can't name places. Question six. Name Tony's siblings. There were four, so name Tony's siblings. Question seven. What were Tony's various nicknames by the press before he became the Camden Ripper? Question eight. What did Tony remember to do when he bought the bin bags in Sainsbury's? When he purchased the bin bags in Sainsbury's. What did Tony remember to do when he purchased the bin bags in Sainsbury's? Question number nine. Following his arrest at Great Ormond Street Hospital, which police station was Tony taken to? Oh, bless you. Someone coughed or sneezed. Coronavirus. Question 10. Back at the back of the College Arms pub, what did the homeless man think the two legs were? Right. Let's dive into some extra details. Obviously, this was quite a full episode and there's lots of details that I put in there. So let's go over some stuff that I may have kind of not been able to do fully in this episode. Unfortunately, when you're going through stuff, sometimes like when you're writing or editing it, sometimes you just think it's too much. People don't need to know everything, every single detail. There's quite a few articles out there which are just dull because it's just drenched in detail. So what I try and do is give you just the right amount so you don't get bored. Because sometimes I go through these case files and I'm just like, I am bored to death. So it's about making it consistent and flow nicely and, you know, it's right. So anyway, let's go through the stuff about Tony threatening his wife. So, as mentioned, they were just in the process of getting divorced. This was 22nd of August 1985. As mentioned, he had saturated the bed with water, so she ended up having to sleep on the floor. He stopped her being able to work. She was a secretary at the time. He pulled out the fuse out of her typewriter. He took out all the money out of her bag. I didn't put this in the episode because I couldn't quite make it work, but he went to her calendar and put a big red circle around the date of the 13th of October, which would have been about 6-7 weeks away, and he wrote the letters KL. And no one really knows what that means. That same night, when she went to bed, he had left a Halloween mask under her covers. As mentioned, he's got a real fascination with the occult, and as mentioned in the story, he used the Red Devils in that mask. We don't know whether it was the same Red Devils mask or what. Around that same time, he had a girlfriend. We don't know the name of the girlfriend. But during that month, he continued to take his kids away for weekends. And, he'd keep them up late. They're only young. He'd keep them up late, forcing them to stay up until like 3:30 a.m. at a barbecue. And, you know, he was proven to be not a particularly good dad. 9th of September, he took a ladder from his neighbor's garden to climb through her bedroom window. Again, he took his children to see his parents in Burton-on-Trent, but by that point he hadn't spoken to his parents in years. He gave no notice of their visit and they refused to see him. So you could see that the relationship between even his own parents had begun to collapse. As mentioned, 3 days before she moved out of the matrimonial home, he was turning up the radio really loud so she couldn't sleep. He was trying to make her feel as miserable as possible. Absolutely nasty little man. When she got divorced, she quite rightly put a restriction order in place, but he just flouted the laws all across that. The law required that he must not interfere or communicate with his ex-partner and their 4 children, or enter or go within 250 metres of their previous matrimonial home. Of course, he broke the terms of that. I think everything I pretty much put in about all the dates, whether I'm going to keep them in when they're edited, but, do you know, they're all in there. When the Suffolk police went into the matrimonial home after he'd been booted out, they were installing alarms, mostly because it's 1980s, they put in alarm mats, which meant that when someone comes in and they step on a mat, he goes beep, 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 alarm goes off. They found microphones in the heating vents, which he had installed to kind of keep an eye on her. I didn't put this in because it doesn't quite make sense, but 2 days after that, in the garage, they found a number of women's clothes and a woman's blonde wig, which was owned by Anthony Hardy, which was found in the garage, which no one can really explain. That's a little bit weird. He kept harassing her with phone calls. He kept following her around. His car was constantly spotted outside her house, even though he's not allowed to be there. He was following her boyfriend at the time, her neighbours. Even when she changed her number and made it ex-directory, within 5 hours he'd found out what the number was and he was harassing her again. Let's have a look through this. I'm just going to see if there's bits. It's weird. It's like you see the kind of things that happen. You see that he's constantly slashing tyres as well. And he did the same to his upstairs neighbour to do with the leaky tap. So as mentioned in this episode, I'm wondering whether there is some kind of trauma for him going on there. The fact that he couldn't murder his wife. So slashing the tyres is kind of his way to get back at her. And because that's why I kind of made that connection with the attempt to murder his wife in the bath, the leaking bath of the upstairs neighbour, the slashing of his wife's tyres, the slashing of his neighbour's tyres. There seems to be a lot of connection with things like that. And there seems to be, because he can't get back at his wife, he seems to be attacking everyone else for that. What else was there? We've got his first criminal sentence there, which I'm not going to mention because that's one of the questions. See, I'm doing well. Now, this was interesting. So when he was on remand at Norwich Prison for car theft, at the request of the criminal defence solicitors, he was seen by a consultant forensic psychiatrist from the Norvik Clinic, which is a regional secure unit in Norwich. The doctor's assessment on interviewing Anthony Hardy was that he could find no evidence of major mental illness. This is mentioned in the episode. In his opinion, Mr. Hardy's offending and his continuing violent and threatening behaviour towards his ex-wife resulted from a personality trait which was firmly based and was likely to be intractable. So again, this is the same diagnosis as when he was arrested for the murder of his wife, is that they said, you know, it comes across as a mental illness, but it's not a mental illness. This is his personality. It's all these mood swings. I think they said it's like a cyclothymic reaction, which they said, you know, this is not his mental illness taking over. This is who he is. This is what he is as a person. And even actually Judith, his wife, gave an interview years later, and her exact words were, "He's bad, not mad." And I think that perfectly sums it up. He's bad, not mad. That's exactly who he was. Although he was able to play the mental health card, he was able to come across as a victim, he used his homelessness, his alcoholism, you know, maybe they informed on that as well, but who knows. As mentioned, 2nd of January 1989, this was interesting. He stole his ex-wife's boyfriend's car. He claimed that he wanted to test drive the car and he was planning to buy it. He copied the keys, he later stole it, and he started using that car for illegal minicabbing. As mentioned, he changed the license plates as well. For some reason, he decided... he'd fallen in the company of a lot of kind of prostitutes and heroin users at the time. Unknown whether he was using heroin at the time. We know that he used cannabis and alcohol. And he, as mentioned, he decided to hold a belated New Year's Eve party for them. And that's where it all went a bit weird. He got absolutely mashed off his face. Threw a large stone through her window of her house. And then he went on a bit of a high-speed police chase. The police set up a roadblock in Thetford, which is just north of Bury St Edmunds, on the A134. They chased him down a dual carriageway at great speed. He eventually lost control of the car and crashed. He was said to be in a drunken state on arrest and refused to provide any details or specimens. And as always, he mentioned no comment, which he seems to do a lot. Again, I didn't put this in, but again, after this sentence, he was reassessed by the Norvik Clinic, by the clinical psychiatrist. And again, they came up with the same thing, that most violence has been associated with mania and alcohol intoxication. The most recent episode was associated with alcohol, but only equivocal mood systems. Again, they diagnosed him not with a mental health problem, but a personality disorder exacerbated by alcohol. So it's weird, as you can see, if you go through all the episodes, you can see that it's kind of hard for everyone to pin down who Anthony Hardy was and even what his mental health problems were. Because he, you know, with mental health, it's not like if you've got a blood disorder or something, they can't just take your blood and go, oh yeah, you've got sepsis or something like that. With mental health, big chunk of it is kind of visually what you're watching of this person, what you can hear, but also it's what they say to you. And if someone, you know, is kind of open with it and they're like, I feel this way, and you can see it, you know, you can get a good sense of it. But with Anthony Hardy as a manipulator, he knew what to say to what person. So hence, some people would say he's an alcoholic, he's a pure alcoholic, and that's it. Some people said he was bipolar. Some people said he was bipolar exacerbated by alcohol. Others said this is entirely just a personality trait. Others said personality trait exacerbated by alcohol. Hence, he comes across as charming to some people. Hence, he comes across as evil to others. So that's why it's really hard to pin him down. Obviously, after he left prison, he had no more contact with his wife. As far as we know, there didn't seem to be any contact. He worked as an illegal minicab driver in London. For a bit, he was living in cheap flats, but struggling to pay his rent. Obviously, being a minicab driver in King's Cross, he got to know a lot of the sex workers. He really struggled to get engineering jobs because he didn't have a permanent address. He got depressed, started drinking a lot, high use of cannabis. Pornography, there was no real relationships with anyone except for Maureen Reeves, who was his friend, and a lady who we only know as Miss Q, who we met in the psych ward, and that's it really. Let's see what else we have. I didn't put this in the episode because it kind of throws the story off a bit, but Tuesday the 31st of December 2002 at 12:12 p.m. At this point, he's been on the run for at least a day and a half. So he had two rolls of films developed. This is, don't forget, 2002. So digital cameras weren't massive then. We were still in the old celluloid days. So he had 44 photos in total, showing Bridget and Liz on the bed wearing the masks. Now, because they were wearing masks, probably badly shot, badly lit. It's legal for you to go in, pictures of naked people, as long as it's not hardcore porn, as long as it's not too graphic, as long as you can say, yep, these are two consenting adults, it's not really a problem to get them developed. Now, he went into his local shop and the local guy was like, what's on the photos? And he was like, a little bit of porn. And he's like, I can't touch it. But apparently Anthony Hardy was able to find another laboratory who were able to do it. It was said it was in Soho, but I can't verify that. So he did get them developed. Interestingly, a friend of his who was called Frank, he took the negatives and he posted them to Frank. We don't know who Frank is. And the note said, Frank, please keep these negatives for me at all costs. He said the envelope contained 44 photos, which he took a look at. Frank can't have been a good friend because he actually sent them to the police. This was just before the murder, but obviously there's nothing really illegal about this. The police got them, they're pornographic, the ladies are wearing a mask, you can't prove that they're dead, they probably don't look dead. Do you know, they could be just two consenting adults, so they received them, but there was nothing they could really do with it. 1st of January 2003 at 5:56 p.m., Tony arrived at the University College Hospital, which is not too far away. It's on Gower Street, back of Fitzrovia. And on the CCTV there, that's when they first saw that he'd changed his appearance. He'd shaved off his beard. Still got the same clothes on, same baseball hat, orange bag, but they clearly saw that his beard was gone. It was down to a stubble. So the police alerted the press and said, this is his new photo. And that CCTV picture, if you're on Patreon, I've put all the CCTV images on there. There's a lot of information on there. If you're a Patreon subscriber, we've had a lot of photos, haven't we? There's been a lot of goodies this week, a lot of extra videos as well. So I hope you've enjoyed that. A lot of people still say that he kind of changed his appearance, so the police couldn't find him. But if you think about it, he did want to get caught. He just didn't want to get caught yet. He wanted to be at the right moment. So he was waiting until the newspaper said he is the Ripper. That's what he wanted. He wanted something interesting. And also, with his picture in the papers, he wanted to make sure he wasn't lynched. Because you know what the public can be like when they get a bee in their bonnet. So Tony was arrested. He was taken to police station. Questioned by Detective Sergeant Alan Bostock and Detective Chief Inspector Ken Ball. As mentioned, the police were there. They got all the evidence. They were there going, we know this, we know that, da da da. And Andy Hardy was going, no comment to everything, which, as mentioned before, that's his legal right. He's allowed to. Ken said to him, look, I want to recover the heads, because that's the thing they hadn't found. They'd got torsos, they got arms, they've got some of the legs, but they hadn't got the heads. And I think that was really, really important, especially for the families as well. You want to make sure that if you're burying a loved one, you want to make sure that you've got the whole body in there. And Ken said, I want to recover the heads, not for me, for the families. Mr. Hardy, what can you do for me? And Anthony Hardy, being utter shit that he was, there's two different counts of this. One, he says no reply or no comment. And the other is, I'm sorry, Alan, I can't remember as I was drunk. That's him replying to Detective Sergeant Alan Bostock. I think there was two times that they did it, which is why there's two different versions. What else? As mentioned, I mean, this is clear from the start. I put this in as well, that DCI Ken the Detective Chief Inspector said, it was one of the most disturbing cases I have ever been involved with. It has always been the belief of the investigating team that a man in full possession of his faculties committed these murders. Hardy is a dangerous, devious and a manipulative man. And absolutely right, he was. As mentioned, you know, with the dissection, if you go, this is why I'm going to do the omnibus edition. When you look back at the earlier episodes, he talks about being in an alcoholic blackout, not knowing what it was. Do you know? Therefore, his hands would be shaking. He wouldn't know what he was doing. But when you look at it, there's all premeditation there. And when they looked at how the bodies were dissected, even the DCI said Hardy dismembered his last two victims with considerable skill. Whether this was part of his gratification or simply an attempt to hide his crimes, we will never know. But they said, if you look at the instruments, they're not particularly good, but he does it very carefully. This is not a man in an alcoholic blackout. This is not a man who's manic. This is a man who's very calm. He takes his time. He pops on his clothes. He goes to the supermarket. He goes to get some more bin bags. Do you know, he remembers to use his... I can't say that because that's one of the questions, but we'll get to that. But you know, everything is clear and precise. Same with the graffiti on his neighbour's door. Have a look at that. I've put it on Patreon. If you're a Patreon subscriber, have a look. If not, you can probably try and track it down. It's neat. It's clean. Do you know? It's not a horrible daubing. It's nice. It's nicely written. It's vulgar, but it's nicely written. Petrol through the letterbox. When you look at how he did that, do you know? Sorry, not petrol. The battery acid. He got a battery. He opened it up. If you've ever tried to open a battery, sometimes it can be a real pig to open them up. Opened it up. He got a funnel. He got one of his empty cider bottles. He tipped it into there. That's a little, that's hard work, especially when you're dealing with sulfuric acid. Kept it in there, then put it through the letterbox. That takes a lot of work. So, you know, him saying, oh, it was an alcoholic blackout. Bullshit. Absolute bullshit. With this case, the police, the detectives got Dr. Julian Boone involved, who is a psychiatrist, to get his advice, because what they wanted to know is, what kind of man are we dealing with here? And it was he's an extremely dangerous individual. That was Dr. Julian Boone's assessment. He said, bipolar does not explain the murders, the photos. There's hints of necrophilia here, and the strong tones of sexual fantasy. This has obviously been him throughout his adult life and possibly his adolescence. And he said there's a high possibility that there were earlier victims. Now, I don't go into that in here. There is a documentary out there with Professor David Wilson, Yawn, which he goes into, which is a bit weak. It's a bit vague. But everyone seems to love it. They go, oh, it must be true because Professor David Wilson said it. And I'm Professor David Wilson. I'm a criminologist. I've worked in the justice system for years. Yeah, whatever. It's just bollocks. Anyway, have a look at it if you want. It's not particularly good. I don't think it's particularly conclusive. But I would say, yeah, if you look at him, there has to be earlier victims, whether it was his wife or, as we've seen, he did travel around a lot. He did visit a lot of sex workers. There's lots of rapes that occurred and assaults. So I absolutely agree. I think it's highly likely that there's possibly more murders, or possibly more attempted murders, I would say, because there seemed to be a need for him to become a serial killer by this point. There seems to be an escalation and a desperation. What else have we got? We got the trial. This was interesting. When he went to trial, on day one, he changed his plea. He was not guilty all the way through. And then on the day, he just went, guilty. And it's like, oh, okay. So everyone had already got all their evidence together. And then it was like, no guilty, not guilty. I mean, he didn't have to give any evidence himself. But this would be that, you know, the prosecution would be bringing forward the evidence. But because he said guilty, no one had to give evidence. Basically, they just had to go there to check everyone was okay with this and go straight to sentencing. Which meant that a lot of the details haven't been brought forward. The police have all the details, but obviously they don't have to release it. There was no public inquiry into it, as Liz's family had requested. That was denied. There was a review into Dr. Freddie Patel and his bungling of the autopsy, which was the reason why the murder of Sally Rose White was seen as an accidental death. He has since been dismissed. I think he was dismissed in 2005, so a long time ago. If you look into the history, it wasn't actually Sally Rose White's death that spurred that. It was the G20 protests, and there was an autopsy that happened based on that, which, you know, he again said it was an accidental death. But when you look at the video footage, it was a policeman pushing this. It was a news seller, I can't remember his name, pushed him from behind. He had his hands in his pockets. He fell on the floor. And basically, you know, that was the end of his life. Horrible bit of footage, that is. What else do we have? I think that's really it. I'm not really going to go into too much because there's a lot of bits that were... There was no connection between the victims at all. As mentioned, the only connection was that they were sex workers and that they had crack addictions. Whether Tony knew them previously, we don't know. Whether he met them that night, we don't know. What else? As mentioned, yeah, he originally had 3 life sentences, but this was May 2010, extended to a whole life sentence, which meant he would never, ever leave prison. Which is good. So he became one of the 72, I think, we currently had of whole life prisoners. Dr. Justice Keith said, this is one of those exceptionally rare cases in which life should mean life. In sentencing him, Mr. Justice Keith said, only you know for sure how your victims met their deaths. But the unspeakable indignities to which you subjected their bodies of your last two victims in order to satisfy your depraved and perverted needs are in no doubt. I have decided that Hardy should never be released from prison. Which is what he said. So he got a whole life order. Obviously, he didn't live that long. I think he was 68 when he died, Anthony Hardy. I haven't written it down, but if I'm not mistaken. What else do we have? There was an independent review into Dr. Freddie Patel's work. Obviously, as mentioned in episode one, do you know, the police right off the bat were like, this is not an accidental death. What are you talking about? But the police are stymied by this. They can't do anything. They need the pathologist to say, yes. Like, if you look at this case, as we've just done, they got the legs. They took it straight to the pathologist. The pathologist said, yes, this is a wrongful death. Therefore, a murder case can be established. The police can't just go, oh, yeah, let's set up a murder case. Yeah, let's do that. You need a pathologist to say, yes, you can go forward with this. But because Freddie Patel turned around and went, it's an accidental death, there's nothing they can do. There's a really good documentary out there. I think it's called The Hunt for the Camden Ripper. And you can see the DCI's face, how annoyed he is that, do you know, he says, our job is to kind of track down murderers and stop them. But, you know, if someone comes forward, a pathologist, and says there is no murder case, there's nothing we can do. Absolutely nothing they could do there. Absolutely. So, do you know, Anthony Hardy could have been stopped at that point. Could have been stopped right there. But obviously it didn't because of one person. And then the irony is that when the police said, can we have another, can we have a second opinion on this? They were unable to get a second opinion from another pathologist. They had the same pathologist. And the same pathologist said, no, it's accidental death. So, yeah. Very annoying. Very annoying. What else do we have? I think that's it. Yeah. Interesting that Peter Sutcliffe literally died 13 days before him. So two Rippers died within 2 weeks. But obviously Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, vastly, vastly more infamous than Anthony Hardy. So, yeah, Anthony Hardy has pretty much become nothing. Not really that much. Very few people know about him. And in fact, when he did die, there was a couple of articles out there, but really people didn't give a shit. It's like the steam had gone out of everything, and the air had gone out of everything, because they'd already gone, oh, do you know, Yorkshire Ripper's dead. Everyone had gone, oh, good riddance. But when it came to Anthony Hardy, they were like, who? Oh, anyway. Right, okay. Let's do the answer to the questions. Get ready. Whew. Question number one. Slurp of tea. Oh, yeah. It's going a bit cold. Question number one. Which country did Tony and his family move to in the late 1970s? It was Tasmania. Question number two. What company was Tony a factory engineer at after university? It was British Sugar. That is a factory still in Bury St. Edmunds, which is why they moved to Bury St. Edmunds. Question number three. Tony's first prison sentence was for what? It was for contempt of court, because he violated the restraining order. Question number four. The Park Centre Psychiatric Unit was in which city? That was Brisbane. Question number five. Tony was raised where, east of Burton-on-Trent? It was in a little village, inverting commas, called Winchill. Question number six. Name Tony's siblings. They were Barry, Terry, Christine and Brian. Question seven. What were Tony's various nicknames by the press before he became the Camden Ripper? I mean, to be honest, there were loads. People were trying any kind of name, but they were the King's Cross Killer, the Camden Slasher and the Binbag Maniac. Yes, tabloid papers. Don't you just love them? Question eight. What did Tony remember to do when he purchased the bin bags in Sainsbury's? He collected his Nectar card points. Nectar card points are just kind of, if you don't, I don't know whether everyone has them, but they're just kind of like a point system, and every time you make a purchase you get some points, and then you can buy things with it. Question nine. Following his arrest at Great Ormond Street Hospital, Which police station was Tony taken to? That was Colindale Police Station, which is up in Hendon, on up in Edgware. It's part of the police training college. Oh, and question 10. At the back of the College Arms pub, what did the homeless man think the two legs were? He said they were like two big fishes, like two big salmon. That was his exact words, and that's exactly how he sounded as well, because that impression was amazing. Right, that's me done. Hope you all enjoyed that. That was good fun. That's the final episode of Murder Mile for the year. We got the omnipotent version, the omnibus edition coming out. I might put it out today. I might put it out tomorrow. And there's a secret, secret special episode coming out tomorrow on Christmas Day. It's just a Christmas blessing to you all. So that's it. That's Murder Mile for the year. God, I can't wait to have a rest and sleep in. That's going to be so good. Anyway, that's me done. Have yourself a good week. Have yourself a good Christmas and a good new year. And I hope next year is good. And don't forget, even if next year's not good, this year has been shit. So in comparison, next year, great. Do you know, even if next year's shit, it'd still be better than this year, because this year has been utter shit. So there we go. Have yourself a good week. Be good. Have lots of fun. Get pissed. Yeah. And eat lots of cake. Lots of love. Speak to you all soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.